My name's Rana Faruhar. I'm an opinion columnist for the Financial Times and an economic analyst for CNN, and I'm really honored to be here. To echo the words of the lunch speaker, people who know a lot more than I do. I know what I don't know. But I'm very interested to be moderating this panel on monetary policy. As my friend and source, Mohammed El-Erian, has said famously in his own book, central banks have been the only game in town for the last few years. And in some ways, that remains the case as we wait to see how the unwinding is going to go. I've done a lot of writing about the effects of monetary policy post-recovery, in particular the divide between the markets and the Main Street, and how QE and rates have affected both asset prices and Main Street America. I wrote a book about that topic, actually, called Makers and Takers, The Rise of Finance and the Fall of American Business. And some folks in the audience were help with that. So very pleased to be here, and I'm going to just introduce our panelists quickly. They're each going to present for somewhere between 20 minutes and 30 minutes, and then we're going to have a good 45 or so for you all to ask questions, and I'll have a few of myself. So I would just set the stage by saying we've had, you know, as we all know here, an unprecedented period of monetary policy, $4 trillion money dumped by the Fed, $30 trillion by central banks globally. Very hard for me to imagine that hasn't had a pretty significant distorting effect on the economy and that it won't have some ripple effects as we now pull back from it, although we don't really yet know what those are going to be, I think. But here to tell us more about their thoughts on all of this are four very smart panelists. Edwin Truman is a non-resident senior fellow at the Peterson Institute. Scott Fulweiler is professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Stephanie Kelton is a research associate at the Levy Institute and also a professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. And Randall Way is a senior scholar at the Levy Institute and professor of economics at Bard. So thank you to you all. And we will start first with Edwin Truman, if you want to come on up to the podium and tell us your thoughts. Thanks.
I'm going to get magic here to show my slides. I do want to start with some personal remarks, which may be a little off the mark, but I think they're consistent with some of the tone of what, I mean that in a positive sense, of what we've heard here. The speakers I've so far have been allowed to wander around through things like Socrates and Kierkegaard, and so on that principle, I'm actually going to be a little closer to Socrates than to Kierkegaard. I was pleased last October to accept Dimitri, this is a really hard name for me, I'm not Papadimitri, you know, something like that. Dimitri is much easier. I usually only do two-syllable names. His invitation to this 26th Minsky conference. In part, that's because a dozen years ago, I was asked to talk here about the trade balance, I think it was, and I had to cancel my participation at the last minute because my mother was seriously ill. And as we heard this morning, Dimitri is not here. I wasn't quite clear why it was said we couldn't say where he was, because I thought he was in Greece as a senior official of the Greek government, and he has a tough job. And I wish him well. As an international economist and an expert, if that's the right word, in financial crises, I've been following Greece over the last almost a decade now, as it has tried to find a sure road to prosperity. But many of the obstacles to prosperity in Greece clearly have come from abroad. It has not been helped by the approach that various aspects of its so-called friends in Europe have put it in front of them. But also, many of its challenges are self-imposed, in my view. And a particular example is its politicization of Greek statistics. As an economist and former public official, I believe that reliable, unbiased statistics are the cornerstone of public policy. I assume most people in this room agree on that, even though we may not always agree on what the public policy should start derive from the statistics, but we assume we want to start there. And unfortunately, successive governments in Greece have not embraced that principle. In Greece, public servants are being prosecuted for their role in cleaning up Greece's statistics. Those being prosecuted include Andreas Georgou, the former head of the newly independent Hellenic Statistical Agency, who, like Dimitri, returned to his home country in its hours of need. As far as I know, and could tell from searching the internet a bit, Dimitri has stayed away from the political and legal attacks on Andreas. However, as Greece's Minister of Economy and a highly respected professional economist, Dimitri does have an obligation, in my view, to try to stop those attacks. They are not in the interest of Greece. So my hope is that Dimitri's friends and colleagues here at the Levy Institute and Bard will convey to him my message. So with that personal detour, let me proceed to talk a bit about central bank and monetary outlook. I noticed that actually this is a two-part topic, so we can either talk about central banks or we can talk about monetary policy, or we can talk about both. And I'll do a little bit of both. Does this make it go forward? Yes. So I have three points in case you want to go to sleep at this point. One, monetary policy, U.S. monetary policy has passed the turning point, and other major currencies, countries will follow in due course. Second, the definition, scope, and timing of monetary policy normalization are uncertain, despite the sense that Esther George tried to convey to us this morning that everything will be and soon will be on automatic pilot. And third, you can be certain that central banking will not return to the old normal. So on the turning point aspect, so this is a set of forecasts that was produced by my colleague, Dave Stockton, my twice-over colleague, both at the Federal Reserve Board and now at the Peterson Institute, colleague David Stockton last week. And these are his forecast for global growth. And you can see that global growth is again projected to pick up. I think one of the indicators of all this is that a commentary on forecasts, but I think this is an area where you actually can use forecasts. So if you look at the IMF's forecasts over recent years, almost every forecast that comes out every 6 months or every quarter, actually, they have intervening forecasts, has been marked down. But starting last June, that stopped, and they were flat. And that was true from July to September, and September to January. And I checked on the web this morning when the IMF released its WIO today, and they have now a slight uptick in their one-tenth for the world as a whole this year relative to where they were in January. And I think that's a sign that forecasts are bottoming out, and in fact, it may be a sign that since forecasting tends to lag, that's part of the rearview mirror phenomenon, that things may get better faster. Do note that the U.S. growth rate here and that David has is at 2.2% this year and next, compared to the potential growth rates, which, as we again heard this morning, most people have under 2%, and some as low as, 1%. One thing I think you can be sure of is that growth will not be this rosy. This is a chart that I didn't put it on the chat, but I should. I've stole from another colleague, both at the Federal Reserve many years and now at the Peterson Institute, Karen Dinan. She gave last week. And this is a bunch of forecasts of long 10-year growth in successive February, starting in February 2011. And this year they have a little tick up, but of course they're going to 2.5%. So the assumption here is that the forecast is 2.5% real growth for the next 10 years, and I think that is going to be difficult to achieve. The challenge for U.S. growth is that we have powerful supply-side factors, That means that growth will be tepid relative to what it was in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. One factor is that we saw this on one of the charts this morning. Women are no longer surging into the workforce. Baby boomers are starting to retire, and productivity growth is slow. A sustained higher pace of growth requires boosting the supply side determinants of output, and that's not something you can do with fiscal expansion and financial reforms alone. This is under the current conditions versus the recent past. Immigration, as we've also heard this morning and at lunch, could also be a very big negative. So here you have a fan chart. We've seen several fan charts. I think this one was not shown. A fan chart of where the Federal Reserve has been since it started its tightening cycle in December of 2015. So that the chart is dated from the month before the Federal Reserve started raising interest rates. So the Federal Reserve has been behind all except essentially the 1987 cycle, but that's because there was a dip in the context of the stock market crash at the end of 1987. So they've been going slowly, and you can be assured, as Esther George said this morning, they will continue to be measured, even if she thought they shouldn't have gone as far one way, the other way, to begin with. So we have long and short rates rising. Since the beginning of this tightening cycle, the 10-year rate has risen by 31 basis points, and the federal funds rate has risen by 67 basis points. That is a normal, if there is anything normal in this world, a normal relationship between what happens to the funds rate and what happens to the long-term rate. But the dip in the meantime was from November to early last year was not normal, and I would suggest that that is because the expectation in the market began about level of short-term rates was that there would be less and things would be later. And you can see in this chart essentially that you've had a decade of revisions and expectations about the long-term interest rates. You don't have to believe, by the way, and I don't, that the expectations is what drives long-term expectations in terms of successions of short-term interest rates that derive long-term interest rates, but they are a useful device to frame your thinking. And you see in the first run-up there in the 2013 period, you had that's the taper tantrum, when things ran up by 100-plus basis points. Since then, the Federal Reserve has been more careful on communication. I think I would like to stop and make one comment on this point. A lot of people go around criticizing the Federal Reserve and other central banks about their communication as if they could always be able to tell you exactly what they can do on all kinds of different circumstances, which requires a much more accurate crystal ball than even central bankers pretend they have. And by the way, sometimes central banking, monetary policy should have surprises. That's called making people wake up. But the Federal Reserve has now been more careful on communication. So you see the run-up essentially from what you might call the Trump tantrum, which has been about 70 basis points, has been much more released, restrained. Looking at the world, just to say that we're coming together, there has been substantial global divergence in performance, but there has also been a convergence in terms of lower unemployment rates around the world. Other advanced economies are behind the United States, but conditions are easing in those countries. And you can see it as well if you look at inflation, where the concerns about, with the exception of Japan, concerns about dipping down deeply into deflation range have largely gone away. Of course, the issue for is that why is whether U.S. policy will or should allow an overshoot of this 2% inflation target. I'm not sure how you interpreted President George this morning, but I don't think she would be inclined to allow much in the way of an overshoot. I would submit, and this is the position of my colleague Dave Stockton, that it is likely that there will be some overshoot of the 2% inflation rate. And the question is how much and whether that's, and you could also ask whether that's good or bad. So that brings me to the second point about the normalization of monetary policy. The United States has started monetary policy normalization, but we don't really know what is normal. We don't know what the processes will be, and we don't know how long it will take. I would submit that we at least think we're facing a new normal of low interest rates, at least for a while. That's because of the concerns about so-called secular stagnation. We have low population growth, which means low growth rates. We have an increase in retirement savings. We have low productivity growth. We probably haven't escaped the global savings glut. And we have an increased demand for safe assets. I think this characterizes the situation in advanced economies. I'm not sure it's going to characterize the situation in emerging market and developing countries. But just one illustration of how the Federal Reserve's thinking on this subject of where, how low is shown by this chart, which was done by my other Federal Reserve and now Peterson Institute, also worked with me at the Treasury, actually, a colleague, Joe Gagnon. And it's a nice little use of the famous dot plots. So on the left-hand side, you have the dot plot from January of 2012, where the median long-term forecast, or where the natural rate, if you want to put it that way, was about 4.25%, compared with the one this March, which is 3.5%. There are some outliers in both cases, but that's where we are. And that suggests that, at least in terms of Federal Reserve's thinking, long-term, over the long term, the Federal Reserve, the funds rate, will be at least a percentage point, if not a little bit more, below where they thought 3 years ago. So here's a forecast, again from David Stockton, and you see he has a gradual rise in the federal funds rate. Doesn't quite even by the end of 2019, doesn't fall short of the median that I just showed you. There are some participants on the FOMC who think the rate ultimately will have to be higher. But I think the point here is that it's going to take a long time to get there. So if the normal for the Federal Reserve is a funds rate at 3%, the Fed may take 3 years to get there. In the meantime, U.S. monetary policy will remain accommodative. Again, Esther George mentioned this morning, but I think it is a thought that, no offense to the journalists, or maybe offense to the journalists, forget. They say, well, as soon as the interest rates start rising, the federal funds rate starts rising, that means monetary policy is not going to be accommodative. Right? That's the end of the sugar high. Well, that's not the case. There's just the point is that you get fewer, if you want to extend that metaphor, you get fewer lumps of sugar each month, but you still get more sugar until you get to something like the normal rate. So in the meantime, U.S. monetary policy for at least the next 3 years is likely to be accommodative. And that means that the scope for overshooting both inflation, which is close to 2% now, and unemployment, or at least the definition of maximum employment, that risk is pretty high. And the question, I think, posed implicitly by Esther George this morning is that it's good, or bad? Is it a worry? She would worry. Others would say it's good because it's desirable under these conditions to test what is normal. And there is certainly an economic case for saying if you're going to be for a long period of time with interest rates, inflation rate below 2%, and that's really what you want to use to anchor expectations, that you should you can afford to spend some time above 2%. So that brings me to what the question of whether where central banks will be after 3 years from now, say. Well, my proposition is that central banking will not return to normal. First, central bank mandates have been expanded, both de facto and de jure. Moreover, markets will expect central banks to keep their powder dry, but available to be able to jump in again, as they have done. There may be a push on the other side to take those tools away from central banks. But the truth of the matter is central banks and their critics will not be able to put the genie back into their bottle, the genie of what you might call activist monetary policy, back into the bottle. And in the future, central banks will not be focusing on inflation alone. The central banks appropriately have regained a role in promoting financial sector stability. Macroeconomic policies, which are supposed to rely on, are largely untested in the advanced economies, but they're expected to play a role. Unfortunately, as also was mentioned today, some of the tools of crisis management were taken away by in the United States by Dodd-Frank. That was this oblique reference to 13.3. There may certainly are new threats to the Federal Reserve's mandate and insulation from political processes. But it is true that central bank balance sheets are said to be bloated, and Esther George spent some time talking about this this morning. They certainly are large relative to history, and here you have just the Japanese, the orange line, and the gray line is the ECB, and the blue line is the Federal Reserve. You see, the ECB has been going back and forth. That's why it wanders around relative to the Federal Reserve. If you think these are large numbers for advanced economies, I could have put Switzerland on the chart at 120% of GDP. But I think a useful point to be reminded about this from this chart is that the starting point for all these three central banks was quite different. And that implies that the endpoints will probably be different among the different central banks and could well be, and maybe appropriately could be, different relative to where each one of them started. So there is this question, basically, of how far and how fast the central bank's balance sheet should be shrunk. My view is that the case for rapid shrinking of the balance sheets is weak. Actually, Esther George did not advocated not adding to the balance sheet, but she didn't advocate in the past. She had advocated for not adding to the balance sheet, she also didn't advocate a fast adjustment, at least from what I heard this morning. And the Federal Reserve is committed to normalizing the stance of monetary policy, starting, however, with the funds rate and then shrinking the Fed's balance sheet as a secondary objective. In fact, it's already started relative to GDP, the Federal Reserve's balance sheet, because GDP has been rising, has increased about almost 2% since the fourth quarter of 2014, during a period in which the Bank of Japan's balance sheet has increased by 20% of GDP, and the ECB's has increased by 12%. So it will, and its normalization will and should trail the normalization of the funds rate, though it can be start in parallel. The case, as you heard it from Esther George this morning, for normalization or returning to something called normal rests on considerations of letting markets work. And returning to the funds rate as the normal primary instrument of policy and get the Federal Reserve out of a position of essentially a type of credit allocation by looking at more rates than just the short-term federal funds rate. That probably is right, at least as a philosophical position. But I would think you could also think about it the other way around. Right? We had, going into the global financial crisis, we had what was called the conundrum, where the Federal Reserve was raising the federal funds rate, and it was not having the level of restraint on the economy that was expected, because long rates did not move, and in fact came down a bit during that period. So perfectly reasonable to think that the central bank in the future might want to put some pressure on long rates as well as pressure on short rates. In that case, it could use its balance sheet to sell longer-term assets and essentially reverse the interest rate process that was used in QE. And I think the anti-inflation argument for getting out of the reducing the balance sheet seems to be discredited. Those were the fears of building it up, and I don't think we've had inflation from this bank. I think the key point about balance sheets is that they are largely endogenous to the other objectives of monetary policy, and in that sense, they should be treated as a secondary objective to position the central bank, as with the federal funds rate itself, for what goes on in the future. So my three points, just to remind you, if you have gone to sleep, that U.S. monetary policy has passed its turning point, and other major countries will follow in due course. The definition, scope, and timing of monetary policy normalization are uncertain, and central banking will not soon return to the old normal. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Ted. Scott, over to you.
Alrighty. Well, this is going to be interesting because, oh no, that's not mine up there yet.
You have to wait for the magic.
I'm sorry. It's going to be interesting because the theme of my presentation is that the Fed's already at normal and always has been, although I'm defining normal differently. So there actually is a consistency. It's just semantics, as most everything is in economics. Given the discussion we had this morning regarding Stephanie's question to Esther George about the size of the Fed's balance sheet and the Minsky quote, I had to go change my presentation a bit and add some of that in. So my presentation is called, as you can see, Minsky and the Flat Ocean Theorists, although there's going to be a bit of a digression here on the unwinding the Fed's balance sheet, which I actually was the topic of my talk at this conference 2 years ago, although there's some different points being hit here. Anyway, real quickly, let's remind ourselves of the quote that Stephanie gave us from Minsky. If we consolidate the books of all the government agencies, then the treasury debt held by the Fed would appear as both an asset and liability of the government. Such internal financial arrangements are usually ignored, so the debt, to all practical purposes, does appear once it enters Federal Reserve System's portfolio. Does disappear. Oops, thought there was something wrong there. Okay, so if we look at the most recent snapshot of the Fed's balance sheet, you can see there are Treasury securities about $2.5 trillion, mortgage-backed securities about $1.8 trillion. So what the Fed's going to be doing to shrink its balance sheet, let's just talk about the Treasury portion for now, obviously is allowing those to run off, right? Maybe even selling them, although that probably isn't in the books. Allowing those to run off and not buying new ones. So I just wanted to do a little thought experiment. As the Fed does that, that's considered to just be a tightening of policy, right? Because they are, you could look at it two ways, right? They're reducing reserve balances, or reducing the amount of bonds they're purchasing and thereby allowing interest rates to rise. But think about it a different way. What if instead of the Fed, it was the Treasury auctioning the securities, right? We would call that a deficit. We would call that increasing the national debt. So when the Fed does it, sells the Treasuries, that's just monetary policy. When the Treasury does it, it's increasing the national debt, right? Now, we can kind of talk about it this way because the national debt ceiling actually includes the treasuries that the Fed owns, which is obviously silly, but the debt ceiling's silly anyway. But anyway, so there's a political component here, which is what the Fed's actually doing is it's raising the national debt, right? They don't talk about it that way, but they're effectively raising the national debt by putting it back out there into circulation, okay? And so we might think about, well, yeah, but when the Treasury sells the debt, or buys back the debt, sorry. Oh, I said that wrong, right? What if the Treasury had bought back the debt instead of the Fed buying the debt during QE and now was selling it again? That would be an increase in the national debt. Gosh, I just ignore everything I said the first 2 minutes, right? And so we might say, well, if it was the Treasury buying back the debt, you wouldn't have increased the Fed's balance sheet like with QE. And that's actually not true, because pre-interest on reserves world of pre-2008, if the Treasury had been the one buying back all the national debt, what would have happened? That would have drained reserve balances, because if you look, the Treasury's account in green is also on the Fed's liability side. So if you increase the Treasury's account by buying Treasuries back, you drain reserve balances. And so then the Fed would have had to go out and buy securities to offset the drain in the reserve balances. So it would have been no difference if the Treasury had bought the debt back rather than the Fed. But with the Treasury bought the debt back, we would say they are reducing the national debt. But when the Fed does it, we call it quantitative easing, right? So, okay. One other component here is that, there's another component here, which is as the Fed shrinks its balance sheet, it's going to reduce the profits that it makes and that it sends to the Treasury. So that's another part of the government's has a budget component. So it's another part of the national debt discussion, which is the Fed's been sending somewhere around $100 billion a year to the Treasury in its profits. So if you look down here at its capital accounts down there, by law, it can't go over a certain amount. So when it makes a profit, it has to just credit those to the Treasury's account. And so that will decline as the Fed shrinks its balance sheet. So again, it's increasing the national debt by getting the Treasuries off its balance sheet and also by not receiving the interest on those treasuries. Okay. So back to the originally planned presentation. Anybody remember the title? So Minsky and the Flat Ocean Theorists. Okay, so where I got Flat Ocean, you might already know, is this quote from Keynes that comes right after his most famous quote, "In the long run, we're all dead," where he says, "Economists set themselves too easy, too useless a task if in tempestuous seasons. They can only tell us that when the storm has passed, the ocean is flat again," right? So we usually think of that in the context of they ignore the fact that there's a recession, or they can't tell us what to do during a recession or a depression, right? I'm going to focus on the other side of it, which is the fact that when the storm has passed, the ocean is flat, and discuss whether or not it makes sense to talk about the ocean being flat after the storm has passed. Okay, because that's sort of, in my opinion, where we are is we're talking about what I'm calling flat ocean theory. Okay, so the key query I want to bring up here, if you look at this, this is really simple, but of course the shaded reasons are recessions. What's happening every single time there, basically without fail, except for a couple of exceptions, is that the Fed raises rates into recessions. So we talk about the Fed being behind the curve, say on the Taylor's rule and so forth. Actually, if you look at it, the Fed's actually way ahead, right? It raises rates into a recession, right? Now you could forgive the Fed, or you could, for the sake of argument, ignore that because there's, say in the 70s, they're raising rates into inflation and then you also get recession. But if we're just gonna look since 1988, again, every time they've tried a significant, again, 1994 is an exception, which we can talk about, but it fits my paradigm, even though I'm not going to talk about it, really. When the Fed is raising rates like this toward the, as we get well into an expansion, as Bob was talking about, it has to turn around quickly, right? And the question is that where we are again now in 2017 when we are, say, 8 years into this say, quasi-expansion that we've been in. Okay, so the basic model that I'm going to call the flat ocean theory that the Fed has been using is that real GDP is basically a function of trend growth and shocks, right? And it's the Fed's job to deal with the shocks, not the trend growth, right? And so then the trend growth is slowed, so even though it's slowed, we're not trying to improve on that because that's just the trend, right? We're at the trend, and so we start to raise interest rates. Now, we already made America great again, so now we can raise interest rates, right? Nothing on that one. Okay. Second one, inflation is a function of expected inflation and GDP versus potential. And so since in the neoclassical mainstream theory, Fed controls inflation and expected inflation, GDP versus potential, then this is all basically driven by the Fed. And then it also drives GDP versus potential. So this is all just Federal Reserves, right, or monetary policy. And then the appropriate way to deal with all this is through its interest rate target, where they're trying to hit a natural rate of interest, and the main approach to that is through the Taylor's rule, as was discussed a bit today, and some other things like gradualism, forward guidance, and so forth. And then importantly, another significant part of this is the view of monetary policy dominance, that the federal government should basically balance its budget and get out of the way so the central bank can do all of this stuff. And so it should be running sound fiscal policy. Okay. And what I'm arguing is basically that's the paradigm we went into 2008 with, and that's the paradigm we have now still, right? And I could stop right now, and I think that would be correct. But anyway, I'm going to keep going. So what we've had since the late 1980s is a series of attempts at soft landings by the Fed. Okay, and this is from a textbook 25 years ago, but and at the time that it was written, the sort of the end of the 1980s wasn't known yet, but at any rate, this was sort of the theory of what the Fed was doing in the late 80s, is they were trying to get, there was a potential GDP there, actually GNP back then, they were trying to raise interest rates ever so slightly so that we could just get back to that natural and just stay there at that trend. Right, and in the absence of shocks, we'll just stay there. Okay, so this is how it turned out, right? Shortly thereafter, we went the other direction, right? Here's what the Fed was doing. Raising interest rates right into that and turning around and cutting. Late 90s into 2000, same sort of thing, right? Trying to engineer that soft landing, here's what the Fed was doing. Raising rates, and we turned around. I should say soft landing the new economy. Of course, we have to keep track of the memes that we had, right? Soft landing the Great Moderation, right? And so the Fed, of course, is raising rates into that one too. Okay, so this is a quote from St. Louis Fed President James Bullard from 2 years ago at the Minsky conference. And I'm just putting this up here. He actually has backed away from some of this, but I'm putting it up here because it's fairly representative. Taylor-type rules have been out of fashion. While the policy rate's at zero, they're kind of useless. But now that we're talking about normalization, it's interesting to look at the policy prescriptions of Taylor-type policy rules. So normalization, right? That there was a storm, and now the ocean is flat again, so we can normalize. Right? And so then basically goes on to talk about how we should have raised interest rates already, right? We're behind the curve of the Taylor rule. So here's where we are, right? We're getting narrow potential, so we're starting to exercise less and less, create less and less stimulus by raising our interest rate, our federal funds target, closer to what we think is a natural rate of interest. Right? This one's not really fair because the scaling on the right makes it look like they've really raised interest rates, but at any rate. So Bullard is kind of interesting. Actually, previous presentation went into this one a little bit, so I'll just leave this one, right, that the Fed has continuously thought they were going to raise rates a lot and then hasn't, although they appear to be on the, at least for now, on the track that they were on. The reason I put this in is because Bullard, for about a year now, has kind of changed his tune and thinks that because long-run growth is slower, what we're going to end up with is a longer run rate of the federal funds rate that's lower, too. So the red is where he thinks we're going to end up. So he doesn't think that there should be too many more hikes. It's not because he's not a flat ocean theorist, though. It's because he thinks that we've gone to a low real GDP growth regime. Okay, so it's basically neoclassical capital theory, where the returns to capital are related to the growth rate. Okay, so what would Minsky do? So, of course, Minsky was not a flat ocean theorist. Not only is stability an unattainable goal, whenever something approaching stability is achieved, destabilizing processes are set off. Okay, so let's go through a little bit of what he was doing. So first off, capitalist economy can be described by a set of interrelated balance sheets and income statements. So none of my students would be surprised that I'm going to have some balance sheets in my presentation. So if we just look at the balance sheet of a non-financial corporation, that's just sort of a plain vanilla balance sheet, and we take the left-hand side, the assets, and subtract from it sort of the non-credit-related liabilities there, non-debt-related liabilities, you get basically the part of the balance sheet that you factor in when you do sort of a net present value or a company valuation and so forth type of analysis, right? You take the cash flows from operations that are going to be generated, subtract from it this number that you see here, which would be the asset minus the non-credit liabilities, because that's what you have to finance to, say, grow the new project. And you get your valuation of your project, or you could do the same thing for a company. And that's pretty standard stuff. Okay, and that's actually, to some degree, where Keynes was going, too. Keynes and the marginal efficiency of capital and so forth. And so what Minsky comes in and does is he starts to talk, about a financial theory of investment. So he goes to the liability equity side, and he talks about, well, okay, so you've got a project. Are you financing it with equity, or are you financing it with debt? And then starts to talk about how, well, over time, as Bob was talking about at lunch, as the projects pay off, we start to not concern ourselves as much with matching the or having the cash flows from the project be greater from the cash outflows that we're requiring ourselves to finance it. And that's where the famous terms hedge speculative Ponzi come in, right? Where you're a hedge financial unit if you've got some cash flows that are expected to cover the debt. Speculative unit if you're going to have to refinance, but you're at least covering the interest, maybe more. And your Ponzi if you actually are going to have to be covering, if you're going to have to be refinancing even some of the interest payments. And so this is what traditional project valuation and so forth, at least in the finance textbooks, leaves out, right, is that matching the liabilities, the cash outflows that are coming from those. Okay, so Minsky was looking at that and looking at the evolution, say, over the course of a business cycle and also over the course of more of a secular trend there. So then if we look at a bank's balance sheet, where Minsky went there is to talk about underwriting, that banks in their underwriting and decision to make a loan, they should be figuring out and making loans to those businesses that are doing the projects, they should be figuring out the cash flows relative to the cash outflows from the projects related to debt. They should be setting appropriate margins of safety and so forth. And over the course of the cycle, as more and more projects are successful, they start to adjust downward some of those margins of safety, right? And then Minsky also went to the refinance side. And, you know, historically, the Fed is changing the short-term interest rate through open market operations. It's not exactly true, but for the sake of argument, I'll leave it there. Through open market operations to affect the cost of short-term borrowing and the liability side, the cost of the liability side of the bank balance sheet, Minsky thought what they should really be doing is going through the discount window for that, because then the central bank would, like any lender, be able to look and see what's the quality of the underwriting going on. And so they would be able to look at things at an earlier stage rather than later on, when you've raised interest rates and maybe what you've done is you've sent that hedge or slightly speculative project into a speculative or a Ponzi project, because now the cost of refinancing it has increased significantly with the higher short-term interest rates. Also, raising the short-term interest rates, of course, is going to raise the cost of the bank and reduce the bank's profits. It's also going to potentially, depending on how you're repricing the asset side, reduce the equity because you've reduced the value of the assets relative to the equity given the duration spread. Okay. So for that reason, on the previous slide, Minsky wasn't as in favor of manipulating the short-term interest rate, particularly depending on where the economy was in terms of a hedge speculative or Ponzi distribution. If you've got more speculative or Ponzi units borrowing, then raising interest rates is just going to push them further into that financially fragile state and potentially a crisis. Okay, so what we're seeing in the new regulation literature, of course, since 2008, we talk about macroprudential regulation, et cetera, and even the most recent literature, say the Minneapolis Fed plan and so forth, pretty much exclusively, there is some discussion about too big to fail and so forth, but it even doesn't deviate too much from this. Pretty much exclusively deals with the liquidity and the capital side. Doesn't touch, and I looked through the Minneapolis Fed plan, I didn't see it anywhere. If you see it, let me know, but I did word searches and things like that. I didn't see any discussion of quality of the lending of the banks, okay, of the financial institutions. It's all about having enough capital to withstand losses and enough liquidity as well. Now, of course, the central bank should be providing the liquidity and so forth. Doesn't mean you shouldn't have any liquidity, but Minsky thought that that wasn't necessarily the right place to be regulating. But also, if you require a lot more liquidity, which we're going to be doing, and a lot more capital, which the plans are suggesting, and we've already done a bit, what you've done is you have taken the two parts of a bank's balance sheet, on the asset side, the liquidity, and the capital side, capital on the other side, the two parts that provide the biggest hit to a bank's profits, right? Because the asset side is where they get their cash inflows primarily, but the liquidity is where the least amount of cash flow comes from. Now, if you raise that percentage of the balance sheet, you've hurt their profitability. Secondly, the capital, that's the most expensive source of finance for them. So you have significantly affected their ability to be profitable, and Minsky would argue, well, that sort of thing might be where you would create financial innovations to get around the regulations and so forth. Okay. On top of that, he also said, well, banks typically need to be right 98% of the time in their lending, right? I don't know if Minsky said that or Randy in his book. 98% of the time because they don't hold a lot of capital. Well, if you double their capital, then what? They have to be right 95% of the time, 94, something like that, right? So why wouldn't you still be talking about lending quality? If you're talking about regulation, but it's generally not happening. Okay, then obviously what we had was a change in the financial system over time. Minsky called it an evolution to money manager capitalism, where it's not even the banks holding the loans and the deposits anymore, or maybe they aren't even making the loans, right? The loans are being pushed off into other parts and they're securitized, and then the shadow banks end up holding some of it and other institutions end up holding some of it. And the deposits go off to the shadow banks, right? And this is all somewhat a response to the regulation to get around the capital requirements and so forth. But another thing that it does is it gets around the changes in short-term interest rates as well, because now you can create loans and structures and so forth, and this was particularly happening in the mid-2000s, where the loans are intended to get around the fact that interest rates might rise, at least in the short term. Right, and so you have a loan that, well, don't worry about it. The value of your house will go up. You've got payments you can handle right now, 2 or 3 years. Yeah, they'll go up a lot, but don't worry. If interest rates are high, you can just sell your house and pay off your loan. Right. Okay. Anyway, so if we look at the financial balances of the household and business sector over time. What we see there, again, the grays are recessions, is that in recessions, the financial balances increase significantly. And so that is the recession. When the household and or business sector pulls back, that is the recession, right? That they're attempting to net save more. And then you can see the cyclical component of Minsky's framework, right? That over the course of the cycle, as that expansion, as the white space goes on, you get a deterioration in both of those. Now, historically, prior to the 1990s, let's say, The household sector was what Minsky might call the hedge unit. It varied over the course of the cycle, but you can see there is a significant positive number. The business sector was the historical move between hedge speculative and Ponzi, because they're maneuvering around zero there, right? And so we can see also a secular trend there that was going on. First, we have the secular trend in the business sector, which then Minsky writes John Maynard Keynes right around there, and it's mostly about the business sector driving financial fragility. And then we turn to it being, through money manager capitalism, a lot of it, in the household sector, right, and driving the economy through credit to the household sector. I was going to skip that one. An interesting thing is to throw in the financial sector in green. And you can see up until 1980, the financial sector was pretty boring, right? And then something happens around 1980, and the financial sector starts to be a part of driving all of this, again, consistent with Minsky's discussion of financial fragility and cycles and so forth. Okay, so we have to put all this, actually, that was just the private sector. We have to put this into a bigger view with the public sector in particular. We got the rest of the world in there. But as Godley told us, there is we have these financial sector balances. Not every country in the world can run a trade surplus. That should be obvious, right? And not every sector of the economy can run a trade surplus, right? Somebody has a deficit, somebody else has to have a surplus. So when we look at the data, of course, who's the historical deficit runner? Well, it's the government sector, right? Because the private sector, on average, wants to be in a positive balance. And unless you're going to have a big current account surplus, which not every country in the world can do by definition, right, you're going to have a government sector deficit, okay? And we can see this again if we just isolate the government sector and the private sector, and the private sector being composed of what we had in the previous slides, household, business, and financial. And again, you can see there, this one has the recessions in there, and you can see there how those move with the recessions, right? That when the private sector goes to try and fix its balance sheet and move back from speculative or Ponzi into hedge, that's it net saving, and the blue increases, and the government sector in kind offsets that, right? And so Minsky says, during a protracted expansion dominated by household and business deficits, the ratio of household and business financial commitments to income rises, whereas an expansion dominated by government deficits, the ratio of private commitments to income decreases. Okay, well, let's back up and look at what he's talking about there. If you've got an expansion dominated by household and business deficits, what would that be? Right? Well, think about if you're trying to stimulate the economy out of a recession with monetary policy, right? What are you doing? Unless you're generally cutting interest rates, right? Or maybe doing quantitative easing or negative interest rates, whatever. All of those are attempting to get the private sector to spend more out of existing income, right? So you're raising commitments, financial commitments to income. If you do this with government deficits, though, you are raising income while you're raising spending, okay? And you can have, then, commitments to income decreasing. They might not decrease, but they certainly wouldn't increase as much as the other way. So this is a distinction between monetary policy and fiscal policy, using them to manage the economy, that Minsky picked up on, and I still haven't seen it in any mainstream textbook. We always look at, we have two things we can use to manage aggregate demand. Three things if you count, say, the exchange rate, right? We can use fiscal or monetary policy, right? But from a Minskyan perspective, these are totally different. One of them drives things with private debt, one of them drives things with private income, right? That's very different. So Jan Kregel, a piece from 1992, so we thus have the fundamental point of difference between the two approaches, Minsky and the neoclassicals. The neoclassical view is monetary policy to be assigned to control goods prices or aid fiscal policy to control quantities. Or, from the Minskyan view, should it be directed to stabilize capital asset prices? Regulation, right? Making sure underwriting is good, making sure there's decent margins of safety, and so forth. And then having an active role for fiscal policy in managing the financial position of the private sector or offsetting it. Okay. Well, so what if we had a world where we ignored fiscal policy and we allowed money manager capitalism to come in and the private sector built up a bunch of debt, and then we used the monetary policy to slow down the economy with raising interest rates. We would probably expect that as interest rates got higher, debt service would get high, and there'd be some sort of problem. Fragility would get too high, and there'd be a crisis. We'd have to turn around quickly. And then we'd cut interest rates really, really quickly and try and get out of the recession that way. And so what we're doing is getting out of the recession by raising more private sector debt, what just caused the crisis, right? And what we would expect to see over time, if you continued that pattern for, say, 30 years, that maybe the average level of interest rates that you're adjusting would start to fall, right? And lo and behold, that's what happened. Not that that's the only explanation for that, but it fits rather well into the Minskian paradigm. Okay, conclusion. The return of flat ocean theory, or did it actually ever leave? So this is a famous piece that Willem Bouwder did in 2009 after the financial crisis that's used by, has been used by folks like me to talk about, see, look at how wrong the neoclassicals were, blah, 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 right? So the Monetary Policy Committee of the Bank of England contained a strong representation of academic economists and other professional economists. Turned out to be a handicap. Central bank had to change from being inflation-targeting central bank under conditions of orderly financial markets to a financial stability-oriented central banker under conditions of widespread market illiquidity and funding illiquidity. So I didn't think much of this for a while. I used this all the time in my presentations to talk about, see, they had no idea how to deal with a crisis because they ignored it, just like Keynes said, right? But if you look at it now, what are they saying? They're saying there is a normal, there's a flat ocean, we had a storm, right? And at some point, if you follow the logic, you can reverse that and say, well, at some point, we're going to go back to being an inflation-targeting central bank under conditions of orderly financial markets, which is where policy is going now, of course. So let's see. I'm going to need about one extra minute here. But so if we look at this, the paradigm of the Fed and economists in general, again, there's this, do we really have a natural or neutral rate of interest that exists irrespective of the financial positions of the private sector, whether they're hedge speculative or Ponzi, that exists irrespective of the fact that spreads between different rates of interest, as Bob was telling us, can move countercyclically? Is there really a new view of fiscal policy, right? Mark, Jason Furman and so forth had this discussion before, and Olivia Blanchard talking about how, well, now we can use fiscal policy, right? Bringing back most of the old Keynesian stuff. But if you read the fine print, it's really, well, as long as there's a recession, once we get back into an expansion and we get toward full employment, fiscal policy, get out of the way, let the Fed do their thing, right? So it hasn't really changed. Have we had any discussion of the evolution of private sector financial positions in the FOMC minutes, Board of Governor, Federal Reserve Bank speeches? I'll tell you, there just really isn't any, okay? Are they talking about threats to the private sector financial balances because of rising interest rates, that they're starting to raise interest rates? Do they talk about that? They don't, generally. They have discussion of underwriting quality, margins of safety, generally not, right, et cetera, et cetera. So in my view, not much has changed, right? They certainly haven't taken on the Minskian paradigm. So to conclude, we have to be very careful, because when we're thinking that we're going to get a soft landing, if our model, our framework of a flat ocean theory isn't the correct one, we may end up with something entirely different. Thank you.
Thanks, Scott. Stephanie?
Good afternoon. So I'm going to be intentionally provocative, as I'm wont to do when I come to the Minsky conference. But so I'm not predicting a recession, but as Bob said over lunch, and I think it was implied earlier in the day as well, eventually we are going to have another recession. And so I'm meant to be provocative here. Can Trumponomics extend the current recovery, even as recession inevitably is out there somewhere, right? I want to just start out briefly. Let me say, the focus of the talk is on Donald Trump and the policies and how I think about the potential impact of what's been dubbed Trumponomics, but I want to try to couch my remarks against a backdrop of monetary policy. So the first part of my remarks is going to be more or less centered around monetary policy and the Fed, and then I'll move into the current administration's proposed economic program. Okay, so you know, one of the challenges of going near the end of the day is that much of what I intended to say has been said in one way or another by someone today. So we talked about the IMF's forecasts. As we all know, it is very dangerous to finish any talk more than, say, 5 minutes before you give it, because your data will suddenly turn out to be out of date. And that happens to be the case here with the IMF, ratcheting up, as we heard, by just a tenth of a percentage point, its forecast for economic growth. Now, the IMF had been, each January, the IMF puts out a forecast for global economic growth. And each year, the IMF had been missing to the downside, right? And so the next forecast was more pessimistic than the previous one, and the next year, more pessimistic still. And this has continued, as you can see, for some period of time. The latest forecast we had until moments ago was the January forecast, in which the IMF said that they were forecasting growth globally to be unchanged at 3.4% this year and to rise to about 3.6% in the next year. Now that's been revised upward to 3.5%, so 3.5%. Global GDP growth. The EU's growth rate is the slowest in 5 years. Growth there has slowed to just about 1.5%. The UK has been growing at its slowest pace in 3 years at just 2%. And as we discussed this morning, and everyone in the room probably knows, US growth has been fairly anemic through most or much of the economic recovery, bringing average economic growth to around 2%, with forecasts of near that, 1.9, 1.7 in subsequent years. So economists have invented a term for this, and they call it sloth, right? This idea that we are in an environment in which we are going to have slow growth and low inflation for the foreseeable future, or what Larry Summers and others have called secular stagnation or something along these lines. So it's not just the US and parts of Europe that are slowing. It's, of course, also China, where in just yesterday numbers came out and growth has picked up somewhat. But China has been growing at a rate of about 6.5%, Europe about 1.5%, and the US around 2%. Right? So this is something that Goldman Sachs said when it looked at the growth forecast. It says, while expansions do not die of old age, history shows that they are at greater risk when spare capacity is exhausted, as it probably is now. So it is especially important to monitor whether growth may be running out of steam. I find this quote kind of puzzling, because the notion that recoveries come to an end when you run out of spare capacity sort of seems to be missing the point, in the sense that if you have a recovery driven by investment spending, which builds new capacity, then, you know, these two things don't exactly go together. The idea that the capacity is a constraint that's fixed, right, and you just simply run out of breathing room. So anyway, Goldman put the risk of recession at about 1 in 4 from around now until the third quarter of 2018. So somebody mentioned earlier this morning that the current recovery has been underway for a number of years, that the average length of an expansion is, you know, less than 8 years, that once you begin to approach the ninth year, the 10th year of a recovery, that somehow history tells us that recession must be near, right? So we are in the midst of the fourth longest recovery on record since 1850. We've had 93 good months, a good run, with just about 2% average growth. We need the current expansion to continue for another 2.5 years to break the all-time record, okay, set in the early 2000s through early 1990s through 2001. Okay, so what is the current environment? What does it look like? This is what Esther George talked about this morning, and what a number of other panelists have described in terms of their own views of where we are in the business cycle. Inflation continues to miss the Fed's 2% target. We can't quite get there. But the general assessment from both the Fed and, I would say, most market participants is that we are very close to full employment, if not at full employment. The Fed is confident that it will hit its 2% inflation target in the near term, that unemployment will settle somewhere around 4.5%, and that in the absence of unforeseen events, right, absent some new risk, the Fed will move forward with its tightening cycle. So the rate hikes are here, and more rate hikes are anticipated. Okay, so this, in a sense, is the Federal Reserve declaring victory when it comes to its dual mandate. And we have done our job. We have delivered full employment, maximum sustainable growth, and 2% inflation. Okay? So celebration time. But if the economy is so good, why did this happen? Right? That's the question. Why did someone who ran with a slogan that he was going to fix things, make America great again, why did that resonate with people if we really have an economy that is fundamentally sound? Now, this guy had his idea about why that happened. At least part of the explanation, according to Senator Sanders, had to do with rising income and wealth inequality. This is a graph, by the way, produced by Pavlina Cherneva, who is the chair of the Department of Economics here at Bard College, and a former student in our graduate program at UMKC. And I was seated on the right of that chart. So this was one of my favorite days working in the U.S. Senate, because I got to bring Pavlina's work to the floor of the U.S. Senate and watch him talk about this in this context. So anyway, maybe inequality had something to do with the fact that Donald Trump was elected president against what on the surface appear to be healthy economic numbers, right? Larry Summers had an interesting report that he produced in 2014. And I find this really interesting. So Summers says, now remember, Larry's advising the Obama campaign, right? For a time, he served as Obama's chief economist. Larry writes this piece 5 years into the recovery. So this is published in 2014. 5 years into the recovery, Larry says, since the trough of the recession in early 2009, essentially all of the convergence in the economy's level of output to its potential has been achieved not through the economy's growth, but through downward revisions in its potential. Okay, what does he mean? What he means is, here was the U.S. in 2007, pre-crisis, right, with actual GDP tracking very closely what was then thought to be potential GDP. And then something happens. Real GDP falls. We enter the Great Recession. We didn't know at the time that it was going to be the Great Recession. Maybe it would be an ordinary run-of-the-mill kind of a recession, and we would get out of it in a year or so and be no worse for the wear, really. But that's not what happened, okay? The economy went into recession. The potential GDP was revised down from the blue line to the red line. So not too much until we figured out how bad this recession really was, okay? This was not a garden variety recession. This was the Great Recession. And potential GDP was revised down substantially as the economy continued to spiral down. Now the recovery begins, 2009. But what happens? Potential GDP is still revised downward. And as the economy continues to recover, real GDP is revised down, revised down. We're in recovery, okay? And so Larry's point is that most of the improvement, right, the fact that we got closer to our potential GDP, most of the closing of the GDP gap occurred not because we improved the real economy, not through real growth, but through downward revisions in our potential GDP. So Larry's response is, no wonder people didn't feel a whole heck of a lot better, right? So he goes on and he concludes, in other words, through this recovery, we have made no progress in restoring GDP to its potential. That's an astonishing indictment, I think, of the policies that were pursued to improve the economy over the course of the recovery. No improvement, No improvement in restoring GDP to its potential. Okay, so where are we today? Pick up the Wall Street Journal or the Financial Times or whatever, and here you get this graph. We all see it all the time. Here's where real GDP is today, and here's potential GDP today. And this is what the Fed is talking about when they say the economy is more or less back to full employment. We've virtually eliminated the GDP gap, but not compared to where we thought we would be in 2007, because that was the potential GDP before the Great Recession. And if instead of comparing current GDP to that potential GDP, we compared it to the old potential GDP, we would have an output gap of about 14%, or roughly $2 trillion. So things would look very different if we were using the old potential GDP as a baseline. I'm not arguing that that's the right thing to do. I'm just saying, by way of thinking about how successful we've been in closing the GDP gap, keep in mind where we thought we would be. So Janet Yellen, just prior to the election, this is September, she says the good news is that the economy might have a little bit more room to run. Now, this is when they didn't raise rates in September. She was saying, okay, might have some more slack. We're not raising rates. Might have a little more room to run. It's good news, all right? What's the bad news? The bad news is that the Fed does have concerns about when the next recession comes. How will it respond? Will it have the tools, the ammunition to respond to the next recession if it comes sooner rather than later? I don't know when it will come, and I don't know what will trigger it. I only know that it will come, okay? Because it's always a question of when, not if, the next recession will come. The good news is that when the next recession does come, it will be followed by the next recovery. And that will be followed by another recession, because that's how the economy evolves over time, right? It cycles. So at some point, real GDP will turn negative. I don't know when. We've got the Atlanta Fed's forecast. The GDP now has been revised down just as of today to 0.5% in the first quarter of the year. We've heard market participants forecast higher growth rates in the second quarter, 3% or whatever. Maybe we'll get to 2% this year. I don't know. But anyway, that was just this is why I say don't write your slides until 5 minutes before, because that's now 0.5, not 0.9. The Fed expects basically 2.1% this year, 2.1% next year, and then a slowing to around 1.9 in 2019. It's always a question of who wins out, the headwinds or the tailwinds. Right? That's what's going to ultimately determine whether we stay in the recovery phase of the business cycle or we move into the recession phase. All right, so we talked a little bit this morning about what the Fed sees, hitting its inflation target over time, continued job creation, more or less full employment, and a tightening cycle that continues. Now, there are people who are concerned that the Fed has run out of ammo, that if the next recession comes, the Fed can't respond, right? They're already talking about unwinding the balance sheet. The last thing they really want to do is more of what they just did, right? But if you were paying attention during the summer meetings that take place annually in Jackson Hole when the Fed gathers and talks policy and so forth, right? I see lots of heads shaking. People pay attention to this stuff. And one of the topics that really did consume the Fed at the last meeting was this question, what if the next recession comes sooner rather than later? And Janet Yellen gave a talk there, and she said, look, we've got conventional policy, and so to the extent that we can get away from zero, that gives us room to do what we normally do, which is cut rates as the recession begins. But if we don't move successfully away from zero in time, if the recession comes sooner, we can always do what we did last time, and it seemed to work, so I think we're good. That was basically what she said. Now, she said we may have to think about buying a broader array of assets in the next time. Maybe it won't be mortgage-backed securities and treasuries. Maybe we'll have to buy different stuff. Maybe we'll have to do something like what other countries, other central banks around the world are doing. But basically, QE forward guidance and dropping rates back down to zero should get us through. Okay? Here's the problem. Here's where we are today. right? 75 basis points. This is interest rates today. So if you look, I love this graph. I got this from Jared Bernstein. I don't know if he produced it or he got it from someone else. But this is all the way back to 1957, and all it does is show you where rates were when the Fed began cutting in a downturn, and then how far rates were cut, and then in the recovery phase, when the Fed began tightening, how high they went before they stopped tightening. So you can see that the Fed did what the Fed does. You go into recession, you cut rates. And then when the economy begins to recover, the Fed raises rates. But what do? They raise rates to a level higher than the previous high. And then you have a recession, the Fed cuts, and when the economy begins to recover, the Fed raises rates higher than the previous high. And they did it time after time after time, all the way through the Volcker years, and then something changes. Now when the economy goes into recession and the Fed cuts, they never raise rates higher than the previous high. So now the Fed cuts, and the economy goes into recession, the Fed cuts, but in the tightening cycle, they don't make it back up above. So they cut in the next recession. In the tightening cycle, they don't make it back up again. So each time leaving themselves less and less room to cut in the next recession. Okay, so that's where we are today. And what the Fed hopes very much will happen is that it can get those rates further away from the zero bound before the next recession comes. All right? If that doesn't happen, then Yellen told us at Jackson Hole, future policymakers might have to get more creative. They might have to think about additional tools that have been employed by other central banks. Like what? Well, we used to call it the zero lower bound, but then we figured out that the number line doesn't just go from zero up, that there's the number line goes in the other direction, right? There are all those negative numbers. We forgot about those. So zero ain't as low as you can go. So we can have negative interest rates. And incredibly, a third of the global government bond market is currently trading in negative territory. So you've got central banks, the ECB, you've got the Bank of Japan, you have central banks in Sweden and Switzerland and Denmark, all putting interest rates in negative territory, okay? Turning government bonds into fixed loss assets, no longer fixed income assets. I mean, it's a crazy new world, right? So how's that working? Well, and I'm not an expert on the Japanese experiment, but what I have read is that in many cases, research is finding that in Japan, people are doing the opposite of what the central bank intended in response to negative interest rates. That is, people are spending less today and saving more in order to achieve what? Their nominal long-term saving targets. People want to retire with a certain amount of money at the end of the day. Negative rates are meant to be a stick, right? A penalty. You spend your balances today or we will take part of them away from you. And people are saying, well, if you're going to take part of them away from me, I have to save even more today to end up with as much money as I'm trying to end up with at the end of the game. So at least in Japan, some of the research suggests negative interest rates not working well. Other types of things that central banks have been trying to do. Bank of Japan, again, here, raising its inflation target. So nominal GDP targeting. This is something Ben Bernanke has been sympathetic about, has written, right, supportively about trying to target nominal interest rates, which is really just saying inflation expectations, right? For a while, it seemed sort of difficult to tell whether we had a hawkish Fed or a dovish Fed, and we're all trying to read the dot plots and figure out the balance of sentiments and so forth. Increasingly, I think we can tell that the Fed has turned rather hawkish, okay? We had the one dissenting vote from the Minneapolis Fed president at the last meeting, but apart from that, it seems that there's a broad consensus at the Fed that now is the time to begin to raise rates and that several rate hikes are expected this year, okay? So here's John Williams, president of the San Francisco Fed. Williams says, look, if we could come up with better fiscal policy, it would take the pressure off of us at the Fed to try to come up with other ways to engineer growth, to keep the recovery going. It means we wouldn't have to do it by expanding our balance sheet. It means we wouldn't have to turn to things like QE and other policies as much. fiscal policy, right? The F word that nobody for a long time wanted to utter, right? Because as Scott said, we had just given over responsibility for maintaining sufficient growth and stable inflation to the Federal Reserve, and we said, that's the way it works. The Fed drives the car, and the Congress's job is just to try to reorient the budget more in favor of a balanced budget sort of thing. So now, does that mean that Donald Trump and his economic program can come to the rescue? Should the economy falter before the Fed gets rates substantially away from zero? Does fiscal policy, can it carry the day here? Now, it's clear we don't know exactly what the Trump administration is going to put forward. We received only a month and a half or so ago the so-called skinny budget, which gives us some indication of what the administration is going to pursue in terms of tax and spending policies, but we don't have a clear picture of the whole array of policies. As my friend Pedro DaCosta at Business Insider says, Donald Trump appears to prefer a micro deal-making approach to grandiose, broad macroeconomic policy in a whole packaged up sort of way. Now, depending on who you're talking to, Donald Trump's economic program is either the greatest thing in the world potentially for growth in the US or the greatest source of downside risk the world has ever known. Right, the two extremes. I suspect that there's probably something in the middle there that we could talk about. So Larry Summers looks at the Trump agenda and characterizes it this way. This is probably the largest transition, ideologically and in terms of substantive policy, that we've seen in the US in the last three quarters of a century. Like, we've never seen anything like this. This is, you know, a monumental shift ideologically and in terms of policy. This is big stuff. Okay, so what is it? It's not the usual Republican agenda. It's not just tax cuts and deregulation sort of thing, you know, and going after welfare programs and that kind of stuff. It's got all these other things in it where he's vowed not to touch entitlements, okay? And there are the usual things, corporate tax cuts, repatriation, but then you got the tough on trade stuff that generally falls into the more left-oriented kind of policy. So Trumponomics broadly refers to the entire agenda, everything from healthcare, immigration, trade, tax and spending policies, and potentially appointments to the Federal Reserve as well. Initially, a lot of people responded to what they heard from Donald Trump and said, my God, this sounds like a huge fiscal stimulus. This guy's like a real Keynesian. And people wrote about the Trump agenda and in these terms. This is Keynesian stuff. Why did they say that? Because Donald Trump said stuff like this. He said it's called priming the pump. Sometimes you got to do that or things are going to get worse. We have no choice, otherwise we're going to die on the vine. The economy would be crushed under Hillary, but no matter who it is, the debt is going to go up. So it sounded like ambitious fiscal policy, deficit spending, and debt and deficit fear be damned, right? He was just going to go for it. So you immediately had pushback from Nobel Prize winning economists, Ed Phelps, Paul Krugman, Roger Myerson, all weighed in and said, hang on, Trumponomics is either going to be disciplined by the market, in the case of the first two quotes, either it's going to run the risk of leading to an explosion of debt that causes a loss of confidence, markets won't let it happen. Krugman said it won't do much to boost growth because interest rates will go up and there'll be lots of crowding out, market discipline. In the case of Roger Myerson, well, foreigners won't let us get away with it, right? China won't buy the bonds or whatever. They'll boycott. There will be a strike of foreign dollars. So the debt scared some people away. It was supposed to be an ambitious fiscal program. No question about that, right? We've all heard the numbers, and there was some discussion about this morning, promising growth rates that we have not seen in the U.S. for a very long time. 3.5-4% real GDP growth. And people like Larry Summers heard this and said, this is insane. Okay, this guy's crazy. But both things might be true. So Larry says, this is so far out of the mainstream of any kind of responsible economic thinking that these numbers are the equivalent of creationism. Okay, the only way you get to 4% growth or 3.5% growth is to somehow find a way to generate an extra 2.1% or 1.8% of growth from one or a combination of productivity, growth, and growth of potential labor force. And we talked about this on a panel this morning. Is that feasible? Can we do better than 0.5% of each, 1% total? Where's it going to come from? Is it possible to engineer that, or is Larry right? It is the economic equivalent of creationism. Now, keep in mind, we're talking about achieving rates of growth in the recovery phase of the business cycle that were not uncommon by any stretch of the imagination until very recently. 3.5-4% is something we achieved regularly during an economic recovery. It's only in the last two recoveries that we failed to hit 3.5%. So is it the case that demographics, technology, whatever the case may be, these things have taken hold in such a way that we can no longer achieve those outcomes? Or is it possible through investments, through macroeconomic policy, to bump up productivity growth, to increase potential labor force, and so forth? That's the question. I think it's probably one of the most, if not the most important question facing economists today. So will Trump's policies do that? Could they do that? The lunch speaker, Bob, was talking about, you know, Trump is like Reagan on steroids, basically. And he said he could have done it. He could have done it. There's no reason that massive tax cuts, properly targeted, I would say, combined with deregulation and all increase in spending, even defense spending, of the sort that Reagan did, couldn't produce similar results today. I think that's possible, okay? Remember, Reagan won re-election in a landslide, and as the lunch speaker said, there was massive economic growth on the back of those supply-side policies. Now, I'm not arguing that those are the best policies to pursue, but could they work? I think they could. So the question, though, is can Donald Trump get any of this through? How much of his agenda, even with his own party in control of both houses and the White House, how much of this can he get through? So we're looking at what the Tax Foundation says is probably a tax plan that would cost $10 trillion over 10 years. Will they try to pay for it? Will there be cuts to other programs? Will they raise revenue to offset? Will it be revenue neutral, as Paul Ryan insists that it must be? Will they be able to use budget reconciliation to avoid having to get 60 votes, which would require some Democrats to come on board? So these are all questions I can't answer. It's going to be tough, but I think what we're going to get is not tax reform, so-called, but tax cuts. And it's kind of hard for me to believe that they're not going to be able to have some success in terms of getting a tax cut piece of legislation through. So I expect that. Even if they are successful, people like Joe Stiglitz argue that these are among the policies that won't work. Paul Krugman says the tax cuts will go to the very wealthy. They don't spend as much, marginal propensity to consume and all that. So it's going to, the hit will be taken by the poor, who are going to cut back their own spending, and the overall effect is going to be negative, not positive. Moody's looked at this, and when Moody's looked at the Trump economic agenda, they ran it through several different scenarios compared to the baseline case. The baseline is current no change in current policy. So the baseline is the blue line, okay? That's what Moody's estimates real GDP would be if we didn't do anything different. And then the next three lines are three scenarios run by Moody's. One is the full Trump scenario, where he does everything he promised to do on the campaign trail and once he got into the White House. All of it. Deporting 11 million people, the whole agenda, building the wall, the whole of it, right? If you do the full Monty Trump, you get the orange line, and the U.S. goes into recession by the second year. Okay, so we do not extend the recovery with Trumponomics in scenario one. In scenario two, they said, well, let's take a lighter version of that program. Let's just cut it way back so we don't deport quite as many people and we don't cut taxes as much and we don't cut programs as much, that sort of thing. In that case, you get the green line. Again, the economy goes into recession, so you don't extend the recovery with Trumponomics there. The third scenario is the one that says, Donald Trump, the best he can possibly do, given the Congress that we have and so forth, is a Washington reality scenario. That's the purple line. It's the one that's closest to the baseline. Only under that scenario does the economy avoid recession in the Moody's forecast scenario. Okay, so depends is the answer to the question, can Trumponomics extend the recovery? If we don't go too far with it, Moody says, yeah, it could extend the recovery. But if we try to track too closely to what Donald Trump actually said he wanted to do, we go into recession. Here's Goldman's forecast. Goldman basically did the same thing, ran different scenarios compared to a baseline. Goldman used the Fed's model to evaluate Donald Trump's economic program. And this only goes 4 years out, so they're looking at just his first term. Now, according to Goldman, you know, you can't do better than the baseline. And by the way, that was the same conclusion that Moody's came to. Under no scenario does Donald Trump do better than the baseline, which is don't change anything. Okay, so we end up worse off in every case. And with Goldman's forecast, we end up worse off in every case, but we do avoid recession in Goldman's scenario. So, look, this is Ken Rogoff at Harvard saying, be wary, right? Beware of pundits who believe Trump will definitely bring economic catastrophe. Rogoff says, well, you may not like Donald Trump, and you may oppose everything he stands for, and you don't want any of those policies, but you have to admit they're staunchly pro-business. So Rogoff says, could he get to 4%? Sure he could. The question is, can we invest in the kinds of things that will push that trend GDP line back up? Can we claw back some of the lost potential through investments in things like investments in infrastructure, education, R&D, the kinds of things that former Minneapolis Fed President Coach Lakota said would raise potential GDP, create more space for the recovery to continue, and allow growth to exceed this 2% or so level. John Williams, San Francisco Fed, says exactly the same thing. Investments in R&D, education, infrastructure raise the level of future GDP and can make productivity growth higher and potential labor force participation higher. So the bottom line, this is the last slide, is there are too many unknowns. When it comes to Trumponomics, there are just too many unknowns. Nobody knows what's going to happen. But my sense is that many economists, perhaps most, have just been too pessimistic when it comes to evaluating the upside risk that might be associated with the kinds of things Donald Trump would do. So that's it. I quit, and thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Stephanie. So, Randall, last presentation.
All right, I'm going to be pretty much continuing along the same lines as Stephanie. I'm going to touch on the normalization of Fed policy that was discussed this morning, and labor markets, which was discussed this morning and again by Bob. And I'm largely going to disagree with their arguments. Is that right? Yeah. Okay, so the premise is that labor markets have recovered. We have created about 14 million jobs over the course of the recovery. The unemployment rate is near pre-crisis levels. It is at or below what economists have traditionally thought to be the NIRU. The employment rate itself has finally showed some improvement. The Fed resumed normalization last December, and they have reconfirmed that they're going to be raising rates in an effort to become normal again. The premise is that the reserve army of the unemployed has been exhausted because the Fed always adopts a Marxist approach to labor markets. We can look to the FOMC transcripts for evidence of their thinking. Here is Lacker. I frequently hear of jobs going unfilled because a large number of applicants have difficulty passing basic requirements like drug tests or demonstrating a work ethic. He went on, one contact in the staffing industry told us that during their pre-testing process, a majority, actually 60% of applicants, failed to answer zero to the question of how many days a week is it acceptable to miss work? And by the way, I guess he's looking for a job. Plasser cited work ethic as a common complaint in his district. A contact who owned 16 McDonald's restaurants told him passing drug tests, passing literacy tests, and the work ethic are the primary problems he has in hiring people. That was in 2011. Does anyone remember the unemployment rate? It was 9%, twice where it is now. If they were worried that this is the residual reserve army of the unemployed when it was 9%, you can imagine how they're thinking now. So we don't have the transcripts now, of course, but something like this must be going on. So the belief is that we are supply constrained, and Bob made reference to this too. This is as good as it gets. So in our paper, I forgot to mention that this is based on a policy brief co-authored with Flavia, who couldn't be here. As we show, in spite of the recovery of unemployment rates, the labor force participation and employment population rates remain down. Many point to the aging of baby boomers, which was the implication of what Bob was arguing, in addition to drug addiction, which Lacker was concerned with, lack of the work ethic, growing disability rates, overly generous social safety nets, increased schooling, both young and older, and other lifestyle choices, such as dropping out of the labor force to care for family members and to have more leisure time. Others emphasize long-term secular stagnation, which Stephanie was referring to, both on the supply side and on the demand side. Lower productivity growth, lack of true technological innovations, so Robert Gordon's new book, robots taking away jobs, and then loss of manufacturing jobs, especially to Asia. So the solution is that we're going to need to settle for slower growth and for basic income guarantee or some other means of providing income to those who are going to be left out of the labor force of the future. So let's look at the data. And this is mostly what we do in the policy brief. I couldn't figure out how you can make the graph darker and the legend larger. But this is showing that across both age groups and racial groups, the unemployment rate since the Great Recession has come down across all of these groups, okay, significantly. But the employment rate lags behind the improvement of the unemployment rate. So we have an increasingly asymmetric response of unemployment and the employment rate. In the current recovery, the unemployment rate fell by about 5 percentage points. The employment rate only rose by about 2 percentage points. If we compare that to the 1990s recovery, in that recovery, they moved by about the same amount. So what has happened in this recovery is that we've had more leaving the labor force than finding jobs. So I'm going to be focusing largely on the people who left the labor force. What is going on? If we take a broader measure of the unemployment rate, at the bottom we have the official unemployment rate. The BLS has the U6 unemployment rate that adds the marginally attached and involuntary part-time workers. So that brings us up to the red line. In our paper, what we do is we create something else we call augmented unemployment, in which we include about 6 million people who say that they want a job, but they have not looked in the past year. Okay? So these are really discouraged people. And if we add all that together, we come up with about 20 million people who say they want jobs or who want full-time jobs and have part-time jobs now. We would need an additional 420,000 jobs per month over Trump's whole first term to take care of the existing number who say that they want full-time work and don't have it. Obviously, that would be a huge increase in the pace of job creation over the next 4 years. So in other words, we need 20 million jobs now, not 25 million over the next decade, which is what Trump had promised. And his pace was something like 200,000 a month. Looking at the longer term trends for labor force participation rates, and I hope you can see those from your seats, what has happened is that I don't show the overall participation rate. It's actually the lowest it's been since 1977. I'll show why it had risen in between. For prime age workers of both genders, it's been falling since 2000. For youth, both the lowest and people in their early 20s, it has been falling. It's only rising for one group, and that is the aged, which raises the question about the supposed retirement of the baby boomers driving the falling labor force participation rates. So we looked in more detail at the demographics, because this is the story most people are telling. The reason that labor force participation rates is going down is because we're aging, okay? So we use two different methods to look at the contribution of aging to the falling labor force participation rates. We use a weighted contribution, and we find that actually the aged are contributing more to the labor force, to keeping people in the labor force than the non-aged. Decomposition shows that the non-aged contribution for the decline of the labor force participation rate is on average about 50%. It ranges over the period between 44 and 60%. You can see that it is somewhat up and down. But over the whole period, non-aged account for about half of the fall of the labor force participation rate. Looking at the gender difference, it was the participation rate of females, the orange line, that led to rising labor force participation rates since the 1970s, but that leveled off already in the mid-80s. And it's actually been declining a little bit since 2000. The labor force participation rate for prime age males has been declining steadily over the whole period. The U.S. is very unusual in this. If we compare ourselves to the other OECD nations, the U.S., this is the level, so this is just a snapshot of today. We have a lower rate than almost all the members of the OECD. This on the right-hand side is the change since 1990, and we are in a small group that has actually had a declining prime age labor force participation rate, and some of them you can see have had very large increases over the period. Continuing with other supply side explanations for a low, relatively low, relative to other OECD nations, and falling labor force participation rate, so other than aging. One argument is that people prefer to leave the labor force. The percent of those out of the labor force who report not wanting a job has actually been falling for the young age 16 to 24, and also for prime age. So actually, a higher percentage of them say that they want to work. One argument is that people are leaving the labor force to care for either aged or young. The percent of families with both parents employed has actually risen tremendously from 25% in the 1960s to 61% in 2016. And if you look at just prime age males without children, the fall of the labor force participation rate was double that for those with children. So it does not look like males deciding to stay home to take care of children explains much of the decline of prime age labor force participation rates. Another argument is that some of the prime age males may be staying home because their spouses are working. The percent of prime age males neither working nor looking for a job more than doubled over the past 50 years, but only 25% of prime age out of the labor force have a spouse. So 75% do not have a spouse who could be supporting them. And 36% live in poverty. It seems unlikely that they're leaving the labor force because their income otherwise is adequate. Generous welfare. In the 1970s, the cash welfare was the largest source of income for households with prime age men who were out of the labor force. But today, it is Social Security, SSI, and SSDI. The falling labor force participation rate is among prime age men is limited to native-born Americans, is actually rising for immigrants, so it's focused in the native population. We can look at the time use and compare what prime age men are using their time for, okay, working, caring for household members, and so on. And you can look at the chart later, but there are only three places where we see a big difference in time use, and those are in education. Surprisingly, those out of the labor force actually spend less time in school than those who are unemployed, which again indicates that people don't seem to be leaving the labor force in order to pursue higher education or something like that. There is a big difference in work, but that's not too surprising. People who are out of the labor force don't work a whole lot. They work less than the unemployed do. And finally, leisure. People out of the labor force have about twice as much leisure time as those who are employed. I guess that wouldn't be surprising. And they spend most of that watching TV. And one presumes they watched a lot of Trump in the years running up to the election. Demand-side explanations. Falling demand, the CEA produced a very nice report, and there wasn't too much to disagree with. We just thought that they didn't go far enough in some areas. Falling demand for middle and low-skilled workers, probably that's not too much of a surprise. Lack of jobs at decent wages, so probably some of those out of the labor force are not willing to accept the pay that is available to them and the kinds of jobs that they can get. That probably does explain some of the dropouts. They don't, we think, put enough emphasis on overall economic performance. Stephanie and other people have presented a lot of data that shows that the performance is not that great, and for a recovery from a very deep downturn, the growth was not strong. Economic growth doesn't create enough jobs. This has been a problem for a very long time, not just in the U.S., but around the world. We have jobless growth. So even when we're growing, albeit relatively sluggishly, we are not creating very many jobs. On any given day, just about one out of every six men of prime working age has no paid job of any kind. And this is a shocking statistic and is something that really has to be dealt with. Is the labor market tight? We have heard several people claiming earlier today that it is. If you look at wage growth, okay, it's been about 2% in the recovery and 2.45% as recently as November. Well, that is not very rapid wage growth. If we compare the productivity, real output per hour versus real hourly compensation. So Rick Wolf has a very nice talk and data showing pretty much the same thing, that what we have is wages growing much more slowly than productivity. So even with this 2.45% growth of wages, which isn't very much, productivity is increasing at nearly the same pace. So there really is no evidence here that labor markets are tight, in spite of the low measured unemployment rate. Employment cost, labor share of value added, employee compensation of gross domestic income, I think tell a very similar story to the one I just told. We don't see the evidence that wages are increasing and reducing the share of profits of income and so on. There just isn't evidence here that the labor markets are tight. Okay, secular stagnation, this has been talked about. I think that Summers reaches the right conclusion, although I don't think that the analysis is very convincing at all. So it's basically based on neoclassical loanable funds theory, and our problem is that what we need is a massively negative real interest rate in order to match investment and saving, because we have too much saving now, even at a zero interest rate. Okay. So anyway, we think that the conclusion is right. We have entered secular stagnation, but the problem really is not a loanable funds problem, excess saving and not enough investment going on. The problem is that we have wage stagnation, which means that the only way that we can get much consumption is through growth of consumer debt. Rising inequality, Stephanie mentioned, so the problem is the marginal propensity to consume is too small. And very importantly, we have a chronic fiscal constraint. Fiscal policy is chronically too tight for the last several decades. I won't go through this, but this shows that the current recovery, really all but the 1973, and ironically, it is the Democratic administrations that have the far too tight fiscal policy, and the Republicans have it a little bit biased in the right direction. So the Democratic recoveries are always through fiscal drag. They've got to compensate the fiscal drag. The Republican recoveries tend to have a little bit more fiscal stimulus. Okay, to near a conclusion, I want to bring Minsky back in. Minsky proposed employer of last resort. His ideas were modeled on the WPA. Minsky actually worked in the WPA estimating Cobb-Douglas production functions under soon-to-be Senator Douglas. And his idea was that you take workers as they are, you give them a job first, you don't tell them, go home, get educated, get trained, and then come back and we'll give you a job. You take the job, you formulate the jobs to fit the skills and education level of the workers who show up, and then you give them training and possibly education on the job as necessary to improve their skills. You take the workers where they are. You create projects in every community across America. You want to produce useful outputs that will benefit the workers, because they get a job, they get skills, and they get wages, but you also have to benefit the community to build political support for the program. And for those of you who are not from this area, you can see an example of a WPA project in Rhinebeck, the artists who created the murals in the post office. And Roosevelt actually was there for the unveiling of the murals and the post office itself. So anyway, projects in every community, and the reason I chose the artist's example and Minsky, an economist example, as workers in the WPA is because there's so much emphasis on creating jobs and infrastructure, including both Sanders and Trump. We need to remember that most of the jobs that are going to be created are going to be in the service sector. We need public services, not just artists. We need childcare, we need elder care, and so on. Most of the jobs will be in the service sector. We're a service sector economy. And if you only create jobs in infrastructure, you're going to be mostly creating jobs for men, probably prime age men, which is a huge part of our problem, but it's not our only problem. We have to create jobs for women, too. We have to create jobs for workers with disabilities. So we're going to need a lot of service sector jobs, too. Minsky always argued that only the federal government can afford employer of last resort program. Only the federal government can offer an infinitely elastic demand for labor curve. Where should we set the wage? We're actually working on a proposal and modeling for setting the wage at $15 an hour, which is consistent with the movement to raise the minimum wage. Minsky always argued that, well, he would always ask his economics class, what's the minimum wage? And, you know, a bright student would raise their hand and say, that's $1.75 an hour or whatever it was at the time. And Minsky said, no, it's not. He'd say, it's zero. If you don't get that job, your wage is zero. He said, unless we have true full employment, say a beverage definition of full employment, the minimum wage is zero. Okay, with this program, we will set the minimum wage wherever we want, all right? So I chose $15 an hour because that is the push, and it will be an effective minimum wage because if you can get $15 in this program, you can get $15 in any job, at least $15. So we modeled are in the process of modeling such a program. We need to estimate how many people do we think will take the offer? How big will this program be? I already gave a hint. There are 20 million people in the United States right now who say that they would like a job or a full-time job if they're involuntarily part-time working. So anyway, we took two approaches. One is we said, well, why don't we take every educational level up to the current labor force participation rate for college graduates, on the argument that possibly we're close to full employment for college graduates. Okay, and so we can take their labor force participation rate and apply that to all educational groups. If we do it that way, we need about 21 million jobs. 21 million jobs would bring the high school dropouts, high school graduates, those with a little bit of college, all up to the labor force participation rate of today's college graduates. So that's one way of doing it. I did that in the past 10 or 15 years ago, and you get pretty much the same results. I'll note that here we only took up to age 65. So this actually is probably a bit of an underestimate. Over age 65 has a fairly low educational level of attainment on average. You have a lot of high school dropouts and high school graduates, people with no college, and we know that a lot of them do want to work. The labor force participation rate of the age has been rising. Okay, so probably the number would be higher than that in order to bring that up. The second method is to look at all the labor force categories and make assumptions about how many people in each of those categories who are not currently working will take a job. So we take the unemployed, we take those out of the labor force by different categorization, and also we have to include those who are now working but at a wage below $15 an hour. So how many of those are going to be moving into this program? So that would be the number of low-paid jobs that disappear from the economy versus the number of low-wage jobs that are raised up to the $15 an hour, okay? And so we include an estimate of people who are leaving private sector moving in. And here we have different methods. We come up, the highlighted numbers are about 15 million at the low end and about 19 million at the high end. So again, we come to somewhere close to 20 million jobs. Now, I'm going to conclude. Let me just say that I think that Bob is a bit pessimistic about the longer term trend. It is true that we're an aging society. We will eventually get to the point where if you exclude immigration, we're gonna have a falling labor force. Japan is there. Japan, the last estimate I saw, they lose a Detroit every year. You might say, well, losing Detroit is a good thing, right? No, but we're talking about the number of people in the labor force. They lose the equivalent of a Detroit every year. We will eventually get to the point where our labor force will be shrinking unless we have immigration. Okay, immigrants tend to be young and they have more children. So that will be partially offset and will be offset for some number of years. But the problem is every society on earth is aging, so we can't forever draw the young people from other nations. They're going to stay home and be part of a shrinking labor force in their own countries. So eventually it's going to shrink. But what we need to do is make use of the labor force, potential labor force we already have, get them fully employed, and that will provide a sufficient supply of labor to keep us growing for quite a while. Final thing, if you want to read more about Employer of Last Resort, this is a book we put together some years ago. It's a collection of Minsky's writings. He actually wrote a tremendous amount on employment, poverty, and job creation. And last year, I published this book on Minsky's ideas, and it includes a long discussion of his Employer of Last Resort proposal. Thank you.